in crisis.
We need to ask before we get to the end of this, we have to go to the shooting massacre in Orlando, the horror that took place there. 23 of the 49 victims, Puerto Rican. On Tuesday, more than 300 people gathered in the capital of San Juan to honor those killed. Hundreds more gathered in Ponce. Puerto Rico's governor has declared Friday an official day of mourning. Natasha Licia Ora-Banon and Mayor Yulín, our deepest condolences, and Juan, for all of the victims. First, Mayor Yulín, your response. We only have 30 seconds.
Hear you.
Mayor Yulín, your response to the Pulse nightclub attack. Well, let's ask Natasha.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I think that, I mean, the Puerto Rican community has been largely affected by this because, as you mentioned, half of the victims were Puerto Rican. Many of them had migrated from the island precisely because of the economic and humanitarian crisis that the mayor spoke about, in search of jobs, seeking more safety, seeking more stability, and encountered this horrific act of violence and homophobia and hatred. The community continues to mourn, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the diaspora.
And Mayor Yulín, your response to the killings in Orlando?
We stand with the people of Orlando. We stand with those families of those 24 Puerto Ricans that were killed because of the horror of those that believe that love is only love when it's done how they want it to be. I have this watch with the colors of the LGBT community, and those are colors that we should all have engraved in our mind and in our conscience. And to all those people out there, being Puerto Rican or not, hate is not the way. And we need to move forward. We need to accept people for who they are. And everyone has a right to love whom they want to love, because love is love.
We must leave it there. Thank you so much, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz and Natasha Licia Ora-Banon, Associate Counsel at Latino Justice Pearl Def. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
Tune in Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival, with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and the participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for our What the Festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby. If the funk gets too hot for your rump, turn the other cheek, mama. Yeah.
Coming up next, we have Portland KBOO Evening News. Portland's gay... Excuse me. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries today issued new rules on the state's wage floor, which starts going up in July.
The nation and Oregon continue to reel from the Orlando shooting tragedy on Sunday that killed 49 Americans. We speak with Zach Mohammed of Unite Oregon about what's next.
And three members of Congress walked out during a moment of silence in the U.S. House of Representatives on Monday, refusing to participate in what they say is an empty gesture by lawmakers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 15th. 2016. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries today issued its rules on how the new minimum wage will be rolled out. The current wage floor is set to go up in July. The first step of Oregon's new wage law goes into effect in July when the minimum wage will increase by 50 cents to $9.75 an hour. By 2022, the wage will max out at $14.75 an hour inside Portland's urban growth boundary and $13.50 in mid-sized counties and $12.50 in rural areas of the state. After 2023, Oregon's minimum wage rate will be indexed to inflation based on the Consumer Price Index, a figure published by the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics to track prices for a fixed market basket of goods. Part of Boley's new rules set out guidelines for how employers calculate wages when an employee works in multiple locations. Many restaurant industry lobbying organizations sat down with labor organizers to hammer out the rules that Boley announced today, and hundreds of comments sent in by the public were also incorporated, a spokesman said.
For the first time in 50 years, Portland City Council has developed a plan to foreclose on derelict houses or zombie homes in an attempt to clean up neighborhoods and get the properties back on the market. The decision comes in the midst of a record population boom and an 11% increase in home values. Portland has 30 homes on the foreclosure list. However, the city will start by foreclosing on 5 homes. The first 5 homes will be placed in the hands of a nonprofit third party to be renovated and sold at an affordable price. The last time the city of Portland foreclosed on a homeowner was in 1965.
Officials from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency estimate that the cleanup of the Willamette River will cost around $746 million. The EPA says that after the cleanup is done, people will be able to eat up to 20 fish per year from the Willamette. Right now, officials say that fish from the river contain about 100 times more carcinogenic material than the current guidelines deem as safe to consume. The EPA currently suggests that no one eat more than 5 fish per year. However, the protected date for finishing the cleanup is 30 years away. This is not soon enough for many people, including indigenous people that live along the river and who depend upon it for food. Rose Longoria, a representative of the Yakima Nation, called the plan grossly inadequate in terms of protecting the health of those who consume more fish than the average person.
The nation and Oregon continue to reel from the Orlando shooting tragedy on Sunday that killed 49 Americans. KBOO's Theo Burke spoke today with Zach Mohammed of Unite Oregon about the Orlando tragedy. Unite Oregon is a policy and advocacy group that works with immigrants, people of color, and low-income Oregonians.
So we're talking with Zach Mohammed from Unite Oregon, a policy and advocacy group that works with immigrants, people of color, and low-income Oregonians. And welcome to KBOO, Zach.
Thank you for having me.
And Zach, you identify as a queer Muslim and a refugee from Somalia, and you've worked with a lot of these groups, including LGBTQ, Latino, and Latinx, or Latinx. What I want to ask you about the Orlando tragedy is, you know, there's been a lot of takes on it. As an LGBTQIA issue, as a people of color issue, as a radical religious or jihadism or whatever folks want to characterize it, and gun control. So what do you think is the most important considerations?
I think one of the most important iteration to think about with the Orlando incident is how we have a person who identifies as a person of color who was attacking other people who identified as people of color. And my organization just recently put out a statement to talk about how this should not make it so that folks are being pit against each other, people of color, of how someone who might have identified as Muslim should not be attacked by the LGBTQ community. And then also it's not a reflection of a whole religion or a whole community.
Certainly.
And also making sure that we are highlighting that this incident happened during when it was Latino night, and how predominantly of the folks who were murdered or we lost way too soon identified as Latinx. And Latinx is a term that a lot of folks from that community prefer, since it goes outside of the gender binary of the Latino, Latina.
Okay.
And how some folks identified as trans who were murdered as well, too.
So do you think our culture has created a self-hatred kind of environment that led to a person of color attacking people of color, et cetera?
I think what has happened is a lot of times the media misconstrues and how we have so many information coming at us through the media that is not concise. And we are hearing that this is a terror attack. This is a American jihadist or some sort of way of talking about the person's religion. And we know that this country is not built on hate. This country is definitely built on love. And then we see that the LGBTQ people who were seeking a lot of sanctuary and how this nightclub, Pulse Nightclub in Orlando,
yes,
was a place for people to be themselves. And now we are noticing that the folks in Orlando don't have a sanctuary anymore, and how much effect this incident had on the people of Orlando, and what does it mean to also recover from this incident.
Yeah, I want to ask you just about the safety of people of color and of LGBT people and the gun control issue. Do you think we're getting off track about the safety of people when we talk about gun control, or is that part of it?
I think gun control also has to be something that we talk about, and we've noticed of how Sandy Hook, we started talking about gun control, and we've had hundreds and hundreds of mass murders here in the United States, and right now people are again talking about gun control, and we should all be challenging our elected leaders. We should be challenging any of the policymakers and people in position of power to be able to make sure that someone who is someone is able to buy military grade weapon and open fire on someone else. And
And so what should our listeners know, or what should people know, how we can help and how we can keep ourselves safe?
I think what we should also think about is making sure that we are highlighting that queer brown and black folks and people of color a lot of times are seeking refuge, and how even the mainstream LGBTQ movement and just the mainstream LGBTQ movement, and how it hasn't really been for folks like me and myself, and how we are needing to have some sort of space and time for healing, mm-hmm, and acknowledging that as well too. And then also making sure that if we are in position of allyship, however that looks like, of making sure that we are not overstepping the boundaries and or comfort levels that folks may be feeling. And then also that we should be listening to some of the folks affected most, predominantly folks who are queer and trans, Latinx people, of making sure that they are listened to and they are being acknowledged.
More inclusiveness then.
Yeah, inclusiveness is definitely a big word. And equity is also another buzzword that people like to throw around. And what does that look like for communities of color? And then also looking at how we need to still talk about this issue of how it can't be just the usual 15 seconds of fame,
yeah,
and how we need to come back as a community, come back together to be able to heal from this as well too. And then also trying to talk about, I myself advocate for stricter gun laws, and I don't think that we should all be able to have the necessary tools or devices or whatnot to be able to make something like this happen again.
Right. Well, Zach Muhammad from Unite Oregon, we really appreciate you giving your perspective to KBOO Radio today and taking time out of your busy day. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
At this point in the presidential campaign, candidates typically move to the center in order to broaden their appeal to voters. But as his inflammatory comments regarding the tragedy in Orlando once again show, Donald Trump is not your typical candidate. On Monday, Trump claimed that President Obama may have a secret agenda that prevents him from combating Islamic terrorism and that he should resign for refusing to use the term radical Islam. He also claimed that Hillary Clinton wanted to disarm Americans and let Islamic terrorists slaughter them, and that he repeated his belief that the U.S. must temporarily ban all Muslims from entering the country, and stated that many Muslims in America are worse than Omar Mateen, the Orlando shooter. And Trump proposed punishing Americans if they don't turn in their friends and neighbors that behave suspiciously. Reaction to Trump's comments were swift from both sides of the aisle. A visibly angry President Obama expressed astonishment that there were proposals from the presumptive nominee to bar all Muslims from entering the U.S. That is not the America we want, he stated, and pointed out that it does not reflect our democratic ideals and will not make Americans safer. Many Republicans refused to comment when asked about Trump's comments. However, Senator Jeff Flake, Republican of Arizona, told reporters that Trump's ill-informed, ill-conceived ban on Muslims was, in fact, damaging the Republican Party.
Donald Trump is not the only one proposing increased scrutiny of Muslim Americans. On Tuesday, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich called for the creation of a new House Committee on Un-American Activities. Gingrich has frequently been named as a potential running mate for Trump. In a Tuesday interview on Fox News, Gingrich stated that the U.S. needs to identify Americans that are ISIS followers or sympathizers. He claimed that the U.S. will need to declare war on Islamic supremacists that live in the country, pointing out that terrorist attacks in San Bernardino and Fort Hood were carried out by U.S. citizens. He said that ISIS followers are traitors who should lose their citizenship. The original House of Un-American Activities Committee was formed in 1938 to look for Nazi sympathizers. Under the direction of Senator Joseph McCarthy, the House of Un-American Activities became infamous in the late 40s and early 50s for its relentless search for the alleged communists in government and the entertainment industry. In 1959, former President Harry Truman called the committee the most un-American thing in the country today. The committee was not finally shut down until 1975. Under current law, the U.S. cannot revoke the citizenship of a natural-born citizen without their approval.
We often hear headlines about youth crime and violence, but what about the advocates who try to work with young men caught up in the prison system and who try to intervene before they get there? The Morpheus Youth Project is a local nonprofit that offers workshops for young men who have been locked out of other support systems. Here to explain how Morpheus works is co-founder and executive director Carlos Chavez, and along with him is Anwan Ford, an intern with the program from David Douglas High School. Thank you for coming in, Carlos and Anwan.
Thank you for having us.
I'd like to start by talking about your years at KBOO, Carlos. You were a community radio producer, and how do you think that experience may have influenced your direction in terms of this program?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been actively involved with KBOO for about 15 years now. I started back in the day. I was just trying to figure out a way to get plugged into the community. I originally was from California, and when I was living out this way, I was just trying to figure out a way to tap in. And I was actually hearing about KBOO, and I started to become familiar with KBOO. And then on one of their pledge drives, I had heard about how you could become a volunteer. So I got involved with the news team back in the day. I started engineering, started anchoring, and then later started producing. Then I started a program of my own called Chicanismo. It was on Chicano culture. And it had a little bit of popularity. And from time to time, folks would ask me to come and speak to youth. And that was something that I was really interested in doing. I like doing those little workshops at, different schools or what have you. And then that kind of morphed into eventually getting involved at McLaren Youth Corrections. And then from there, I was trying to figure out what's a good way to kind of tie in, the radio experience that I had with KBOO and to, eventually build a partnership with KBOO so that we can get those voices out on the air. And so now that's something that we do through Prison Pipeline. So from time to time, we get the voices of those youth. And what I'm working on now, too, is getting more of the voices of the youth that are out in East Portland, such as Anwan, on the radio so that folks can get their perspective on things. So
let's go back for a second to Chicanismo. One of the major focuses of Chicanismo was history and culture.
Yep.
And now with the Morpheus Youth Project, you are also emphasizing history and culture as well. Do you see a direct connection between Chicanismo and how you are managing the program?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, when I was doing Chicanismo, not only was it something that was informative, you know, for people here in Portland. I mean, I felt it was important to do the program just because I started to realize, you know, in California, it's like Chicano Mecca over there, especially like in LA. So everybody's familiar with that culture over there. But here, it almost seemed like something that was new, you know, like you have a lot of first and second generation Latinos that are here. And so the whole idea of Chicanismo was something that was foreign to a lot of people. And so it was informative for a lot of folks here, but also it taught me a lot when I was doing the program. So my idea was if I was to bring this stuff forward and, you know, basically I'm kind of I use radio because it's interesting, you know, learning how to use the tools and stuff like that. I introduce that to the youth that I work with. But then I bring in those historical things like, you know, Chicano culture into the mix. Sometimes I just do straight up Latino groups, you know, so, but I'm always trying to figure out a way to tie that stuff together. And it's in you know, a lot of the youth that I work with are Latinos. Anwan's part Latino, you know, I mean, and so by teaching them these stories it helps them to kind of connect the dots with their own lives. And it just helps them to kind of understand a broader understanding of identity. A lot of these youth are gang, you know, affected in some way that I'm working with. And they're so tied to it, especially the work that I do at Multnomah County Juvenile Justice. A lot of youth are in there that are gang affiliated, and they're so about that. They talk about it constantly. And so I try and use those lessons of, you know, whatever conversations they're having about their gangs, I try and tie it into the historical roots as to kind of how that even came about. You know, and then when they see that, like even just the gang structure, how far that goes back, and they see that, oh, that's not actually what the intention of this whole thing was. You know, that's not what the original intention of this was. It starts to help them to understand like who they really are, you know, and that it's not just this narrow focused thing that they've kind of been presented with. It's something that's a lot bigger, you know, and they're part of this larger and bigger existence. So for me, I think it helps them to kind of realize that there's a bigger picture out there in general, and hopefully gets them to start thinking about things in a different way. So
why do you think that, given that it's that important towards the formation of their personal identity and their connections to their community, I mean, why do you think that sort of history, especially Chicano history, has been so suppressed or marginalized in their education to the point that they get involved in your program?
I mean, that's kind of a long story, but I mean, I truly believe that there's folks out there that don't want us to know who we are. And, you know, there's folks that are in power that want to stay in power and don't want anybody to get in the way of that. And I mean, that alone explains why we're not being reflected in the history books at school. I often talk to the students. I haven't actually talked to Anwan a whole lot about this quite yet. He just started with, he's a new intern with me at Morpheus Youth Project. He goes to David Douglas High School. And we've just been starting to have some conversations about different things, you know, life and what have you. You know, we've had some good conversations about gang structures and kind of what that looks like here in Portland. And I don't know, one of the things that made me feel really good about, you know, having that conversation is him saying that what he's doing with my organization keeps him away from that, you know. But anyways, I'm sorry, I'm kind of losing track of what the original question was here. Sometimes I veer off.
No, well, I was just curious. I mean, considering how important it is for socialization to understand your own roots and where you came from, you know, why is it that we as a society have taken really a self-destructive step and really suppressed that sort of the passing on of that cultural knowledge.
Yeah, I mean it's a tough question. You know what I mean? Because that's the thing that most Latinos and African American youth, Asian youth, we're being taken away from that. So that's a question that we're often asking. You know, and I think that's a question that young people like Anwan and like other youth that I'm working with, not only in East Portland, but that are incarcerated, are dealing with on a regular basis, but aren't exactly sure how to put their finger on it. You know, and really that question is for the folks that are in power and that are keeping that info from us. You know what I mean? Like, why aren't we in the history books? You know, so those are the types of, I mean, I have my idea of why I think that exists, and I just think it's about power, really.
Well, I'm going a little long here, and we don't have much time left.
That's okay.
Anwan, I don't want to leave you out of the conversation. I'd like to hear from you. How'd you hear about the Morpheus Project, and what attracted you to it?
Well, I go to David Douglas High School, like he said, and just reaching out, you know, trying to find different groups, you know, to stay out of trouble. And it was one of the resources that was in the sunroom at my high school, provided at my high school. And then I just signed up for the internship, and then I landed the internship with NYP, Morpheus Youth Project. And then it was like the music side of it, you know, that I entered into, like the internship part.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
And do you see going forward staying involved and getting further integrated into the program?
Yes, I do. I just started recently, and I'm pretty far ahead, you know, and it's a good experience that I'm getting out of this program, and I really thank them for giving me this opportunity to enter into this program.
That's excellent. Carlos, in your experience as a youth advocate, what's the greatest need that you see that needs to be fulfilled?
I probably should have left it with Anwan on that one.
But yeah, that's true. Like, maybe.
What do you think about that question? What do you think it is that young people need these days? You know, what do you think they're missing?
I think missing like I would say like the mentorship of somebody older than them to give them like not really like a sense of what to do, but just to show them like you can either do this or you can do that, but just always know that there's repercussions to everything.
I kind of want to add to that, actually. That's actually the same thing that I was going to mention. I'm glad you said that. Makes me feel better, you know, that I'm on the right track. But I think a lot of youth today, I think there's a lot of adults that are just like, they feel a strong disconnect with the youth and vice versa. And so we're allowing that disconnect to take place, and we're not like connecting ourselves with the young people and creating a like trusting relationships with folks, just being with each other, you know, and that's something that I think we just need to build in general. You know, it doesn't matter like from whatever perspective you're coming, but adults and young people need to be spending time together.
All right, we've only got a few seconds left, but quickly, how can KBOO listeners support the Morpheus Youth Project?
There's a number of different ways. We got a few different events that are coming up pretty soon. Just come and check those events out. This Saturday, we've got a breakdance jam that's going on to commemorate the New Birth Breakdance Crew's 7-year anniversary. That's a free event that's happening out in East Portland at the Urco Center. It starts at 4:00. Anybody can check that out. It's going to be awesome. There's a lot of stuff going on. We got a fundraising event that's going on the 25th at Mississippi Pizza. There's a number of different MCs that are going to come out and perform. But check us out on morpheusyouth.org. Check us out on Morpheus Youth Project on Instagram and on Facebook. And subscribe. You know, subscribe to us.
Well, thank you very much, Carlos and Anwan, for joining us today. Carlos Chavez, co-founder of the Morpheus Youth Project, and Anwan Ford, an intern with that program. You can find out more about their work online, again, at www.morpheusyouth.com. That's spelled MORPHEUSYOUTH.com.
Three members of Congress walked out during a moment of silence in the U.S. House of Representatives Monday night, refusing to participate in what they say is an empty gesture by lawmakers. On Tuesday, calls for legislative action on guns grew louder on one side of the aisle, while silence on the issue was ever more deafening on the other. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
House Speaker Paul Ryan called for a moment of silence in memory of the victims of the terrorist attack in Orlando. At least three people walked out of the chamber during the moment, including Connecticut Representative Jim Hines, who earlier in the day told his colleagues on the floor that he would not participate.
Silence. Not me. Not anymore. I will no longer stand here absorbing the faux concern, contrived gravity, and tepid smugness of a House complicit in the weekly bloodshed. Sooner or later, the country will hold us accountable for our inaction.
Without objection, 5-minute voting will continue.
As soon as House Speaker Ryan banged the gavel to return to business as usual, the chamber erupted in voices calling for action on gun control bills, and a showdown between Ryan and Assistant Democratic Leader Jim Clyburn ensued.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
The gentleman shall state his inquiry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I am really concerned that we have just today have a moment of silence, and later this week, the 17th.
Is the gentleman stating a parliamentary inquiry?
Yes.
Ryan invoked parliamentary procedure to silence Representative Clyburn at the podium, and over the raucous voices of U.S. lawmakers calling for the Republican leader to bring gun control bills to the floor, he returned the body to consideration of an unrelated measure. Tuesday morning, the two parties held dueling press conferences. The Democrats began with caucus chair, California Representative Javier Becerra.
We understand it's important to express to the people of this country this moment of silence, to let the families of the victims know that we're thinking of them. But by God, this is the people's house. And if we can't stand up and then do something, then we're in trouble. There are any number of things that could be done. We must do a better job of identifying and checking the background of those who seek to buy weapons, especially assault weapons. We could ask people to pass the legislation that Mike Thompson introduced and has asked through a discharge petition that every single member of the House sign on to so we can have this bill debated, to make sure that if you can't fly because you're on a no-fly list because of your potential to commit terrorist acts, then you should not be able to buy a weapon by going into a gun shop and walking out with something that could let you do your mass destruction. We have to do a better job of responding to the red flags waved by people who are on the edge and showing signs of fanatic extremism or severe psychological strain. But what we shouldn't do is simply bow our heads for a moment of silence. Unfortunately, that's all Speaker Ryan would allow us to do yesterday.
These 49 victims join a long list of victims and families that are hurting because their Congress will stand for a moment of silence but do absolutely nothing. Don't even talk about it. Don't even bring it up. Don't hold a hearing. Call a select committee on umpteen other things, but not when it comes to gun violence in America. Nothing, nada, zip.
We've had over 30 moments of silence since the tragedy in Sandy Hook. We've had moments of silence ad nauseum. But I'll tell you what we haven't had. We haven't had one single vote on any piece of legislation to address the issue of gun violence prevention. We've not had one single vote on any piece of legislation that tries to make sure that we do everything possible to keep people who shouldn't have guns from getting guns. It's an embarrassment. It's an act of cowardice. And we should all be ashamed of ourselves.
Why is it that this continued to happen and we are the do-nothing Congress? Now, you know, it's questioned about whether this was a hate crime. Clearly, it was a hate crime. It was a LGBT Pride Month and the club. I mean, it was clear a hate crime. Now, we in Congress need to do something other than that moment of silent prayer.
What we need is sustained action, many moments of sustained action to get things done, to keep the American people safe. There are a number of solutions that will do that. We're calling on our Republican leaders in the House to bring those bills to the floor. Let us debate them. I serve on the Judiciary Committee. We haven't had one vote on a single measure that would help protect Americans from gun violence. It's a national disgrace that that has not happened.
Becerra was followed by caucus vice chair, Representative Joe Crowley, California Representative Mike Thompson, Florida's Corinne Brown, and Rhode Island's David Cicilline. During the Republican press conference, party leaders told the press that they plan to package a raft of anti-terrorism bills that have already passed in the U.S. House. They talked about terrorism, acts of war, and homegrown jihad, but the word guns was not uttered, even once. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
In my interview a few minutes ago with Carlos Chavez and Anwan Ford, I gave out an incorrect email address. The correct email address for them is actually www.morpheus.org, not .com. KBOO's political poet Dan Raphael has a poetic justice perspective on the Orlando massacre.
Targets: lesbians, gays, bi, trans, African Americans, Latinos, Muslims, co-workers, fellow students, grade schoolers, moviegoers, politicians, soldiers, random people on the street. With so damn many targets, you need all the bullets you can carry. This is Dan Raphael for Poetic Justice, hoping for more of both real soon.
You are listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for the news from the BOO at 5:45, followed by Love and Revolution at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in Portland is around 68 degrees and some isolated thunderstorms with a 30% chance of rain. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you've got mostly cloudy skies with a 20% chance of showers. On this day in history, the Union of European Football Association was founded in Switzerland to organize the sport we know as soccer. Our quote from today comes from Albert Camus. He said, "Everything I know about mortality and the obligations of men, I owe to football."
Judge Aaron Persky, now infamous as the Stanford rape judge, has been removed from an upcoming sexual assault case. He's also the subject of growing criticism, including from one of the jurors on the Stanford case. The Santa Clara County District Attorney said prosecutors lack confidence that Judge Persky can fairly preside over a case in which a male nurse sexually assaulted an anesthetized female patient. Discussion to remove Persky from this case began after he dismissed an unrelated misdemeanor case mid-trial before the jury could deliberate. Several potential jurors in recent cases in Persky's court said they could not serve on a jury where he was the judge. One of the male jurors in the Stanford case published an open letter to Judge Persky in the Palo Alto Weekly, where he wrote that jurors felt that their unanimous verdict was marginalized by the judge's personal opinion.
The Supreme Court on Monday struck down the Recovery Act, a 2014 Puerto Rico law that would allow public utilities there to restructure $20 billion in debt. With over $72 billion in debt, Puerto Rico has argued it needs to restructure some of it under Chapter 9. This part of the bankruptcy law is for insolvent local governments, but specifically and without explanation excludes Puerto Rico. Justice Clarence Thomas, writing for the 5-2 majority, said that the law was at odds with the part of the federal bankruptcy code that says only Congress may enact bankruptcy laws. Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were the two judges who voted in favor of letting the Puerto Rican law stand. Justice Samuel Alito had recused himself from the case due to a financial conflict. The House of Representatives passed a quasi-bankruptcy bill this month that would give U.S. territories, including Puerto Rico, Chapter 9 protection. The Obama administration officials have expressed hope that the Senate will enact this measure before July 1st, when Puerto Rico is supposed to make debt payments to the totaling nearly $2 billion.
Scientists estimate that there will once again be a large marine dead zone in the northern Gulf of Mexico this summer. Dr. Nancy Rabelais, executive director of Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, is co-author of a new paper estimating the size of this area of low oxygen. FSRN's Sean Keenan spoke with her and found out that the hypoxic zone is ultimately caused by pollution from runoff from states bordering the Mississippi River and could be about the size of Connecticut this summer.
What's the northern Gulf of Mexico dead zone and how is it formed?
The area off primarily Louisiana, but also Mississippi and Texas, is an area that is devoid of oxygen in the lower water column near the seabed in the summertime. It's due to the Mississippi River. Basically, the fresh water creates a two-layer system, and the nutrients that come from the river stimulate the growth of small phytoplankton, which are generally good for the system, but if there's too many, they fall to the bottom, and the decay depletes the oxygen in the bottom water.
And what happens to the marine life in this hypoxic zone?
Normal dissolved oxygen is around 5 to 6 in the summertime, and it gets down to 2 or below 2 to 1 or sometimes 0. And at about 2, most of the things that can swim out of the area will try to leave the areas. Sharks and rays will go at 3. And then the remaining organisms, if the low oxygen stays and is severely low, then the animals that live in the sediments will die off.
Can you just paint a picture for our listeners of what the area on the bottom there might look like before there's a dead zone there and compare that with what it might look like afterwards?
The seabed in the northern Gulf of Mexico is pretty uniform, doesn't have a lot of structure to it. So there's no rocks, it's just a mud bottom. We have oxygen meters on an offshore oil platform that we maintain, and so we know the oxygen levels at all times. So we do a lot of diving, and when you're in the surface waters, you see lots of fish. You can usually see some sort of plankton bloom. And as you go down through the water, you will see fish. And then when the oxygen starts to change to below 2, you don't see any fish anymore. And you swim down to the bottom, and most of the time it's usually pretty dark, and it's hard to see anything, but you definitely don't see any fish. And if you swim out over the seabed, then you may see some dead organisms laying on the surface.
And you're predicting the size of the hypoxic zone or the dead zone this summer. What are your predictions?
We are predicting that it's going to cover about 6,800 square miles, and that could be higher or lower depending on whether we have a storm or anything. And that's about 3 times higher than the hypoxia task force goal of 200 square miles.
And how does that compare to previous years?
It's called average this year because it's within the range of the last 5 years, but average is not acceptable when you have a huge area that does not have enough oxygen in the bottom.
There is a hypoxia action plan. What is it, and can you tell us if it's being met?
The hypoxia action plan was approved in 2001 and reviewed and reapproved in 2008. And the goal was still 5,000 square miles with a 5-year running average by the year 2015. And you can see we're not in 2015 anymore, we're in 2016. And the hypoxia task force changed the time to reach those limits in 2014 and extended it 25 more years. So with an intermediate goal of reducing the nutrients in the river by 20%. How effective the task force has been, it's been mostly an education issue for the states that produce most of the nutrients, and working with the USDA and conservation services, and just to teach the farmers better nutrient management. But until it changes on the whole scale, it's not going to make much of a difference.
And one of the reasons that the plan isn't being met is because the nitrate loading that's in the waters coming out of the Mississippi, that's not going down. Isn't it going up? And why would that be?
It's about level right now. It's gone up 3 times since the 1950s. We can't ever expect to get back to the 1950s, but we figure with about a 30 to 40% reduction, we can get back to a level that would meet the 2,000 square size. The high nitrate levels are a concern in the Midwest as well because of drinking water standards, and cities like Des Moines and Columbus have to put on tertiary treatment. They have lakes and reservoirs that have harmful algal blooms because of too much nitrate. So it's not just the Gulf of Mexico issue. It's a whole watershed issue.
Dr. Nancy Rabelais is the executive director of Louisiana University's Marine Consortium and a leading expert on the Gulf of Mexico dead zone. She joined us by cell phone from Louisiana. For FSRN, I'm Sean Canaan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Tallner, John Pacheco, Dan Raphael, Ray Bodwell, Grace Ann Smith, and Dalat Badulo. Our producer is Theo Burke. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer tonight is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Doug McVeigh guest hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. His topic is public drug use. His guests include makers of the documentary Safer Spaces, a community discussion on public drug use, health, and community safety. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Per Foggering hosts a combo plate program, Creditors and Predators, Debt and Destruction, and Other Hot Items. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. We'll go to Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with Rob Spillman about his memoir, All Tomorrow's Parties. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking